What is the world to do when a particular government cannot or will not stop mass atrocities and human rights abuses within its borders? What if the state itself is the source of this violence? Who's responsible for ending the violence and bringing its perpetrators to justice? For the past 20 years, quote, humanitarian intervention has been the key concept in the post-Cold War debate over international military action to stop such violence within a state. But a new concept called the responsibility to protect, or R2P, is gaining ground in the world community, seeking to reframe the debate on state sovereignty and the warrants for military intervention. Formally introduced in 2001 by a Canadian government-sponsored commission, the R2P paradigm was taken up by various commissions of the United Nations in 2004, then unanimously endorsed the next year by 150 heads of states and government, meeting as the General Assembly in the United Nations' 60th anniversary year. Each individual state, these leaders agreed, quote, has the responsibility to protect its populations from genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, and crimes against humanity. We accept that responsibility and will act in accordance with it. The international community, through the United Nations, also has a responsibility to help protect populations from genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, and crimes against humanity. In this context, we, the leaders, are prepared to take collective action in a timely and decisive manner through the Security Council, should peaceful means be inadequate and national authorities are manifestly failing to protect their populations, unquote. But despite this assembly's endorsement, R2P is not universally accepted as the prevailing concept of sovereignty in international relations, nor does it have the force of international law. And as we shall hear today, it has vigorous supporters and critics who draw upon a wide range of religious, historical, and philosophical arguments. We're fortunate today to have brought together a terrific panel of thinkers on this question, and I'm delighted to introduce them in the order in which they'll speak. Each is exceptionally distinguished in his field, so in the interest of time, I'll provide only brief introductions that leave out most of their awards and accomplishments. More complete biographical sketches are available on our website. David Hollenbach, SJ, is University Professor of Human Rights and International Justice at Boston College, where he's based in the Department of Theology. His scholarly work brings theological ethics to bear upon international politics, with a strong focus on human rights in theory and practice. His most recent books are The Global Face of Public Faith, Politics, Human Rights, and Christian Ethics, and The Common Good in Christian Ethics in 2002. And he's the editor of two recent books on refugees, Driven from Home, Protecting the Rights of Forced Migrants, just out this year, and Refugee Rights, Ethics, Advocacy, and Africa. And as I understand it, he teaches every other year at Hekima University, Hekima?
Occasionally.
Time to time in Nairobi, Kenya as well. His PhD is from Yale University. Mahmoud Mamdani is the Herbert Lehman Professor of Government at Columbia University, where he holds appointments in anthropology, political science, and the School of International and Public Affairs. He specializes in the study of African history and politics and has written extensively on colonialism, genocide, and human rights. A native of Uganda, Professor Mamdani has taught at universities in Tanzania, Uganda, and South Africa before joining the Columbia faculty in 1999. Among his many books are last year's Saviors and Survivors, Darfur, Politics, and the War on Terror, and Good Muslim, Bad Muslim, America, the Cold War, and the Roots of Terror. His PhD is from Harvard University. And last but not least, Alan Wolf is the founding director of the Boisi Center and the professor of political science here at Boston College. Widely known public intellectual and frequent commentator to New York Times, Washington Post, and other journals, his scholarly work focuses on the relation of religion, politics, and culture in practice and theory. He's the author of more than a dozen books, including the forthcoming Political Evil, What It Is and How to Combat It, out next year, as well as The Future of Liberalism, The Transformation of American Religion, and One Nation After All. His PhD is from the University of Pennsylvania. So each speaker will have approximately 15 minutes for opening remarks, followed by a very brief response if required. And the remaining time will be given to you all for questions, comments, and engagement with the panel. So let's begin with Father Hollenbach.
Thank you very much, Eric. It's a great pleasure to be here with you, and it's a great pleasure to be part of this panel. I look forward to some lively discussion over the course of the next hour and a half or thereabouts. As Eric Owens just pointed out, that in 2001, stimulated by the Rwanda genocide, in which nearly 1 million people were killed in the course of approximately 100 days, This international commission established by the Canadian government, the International Commission on Intervention and State Sovereignty, issued a report entitled The Responsibility to Protect, thus the title of our conversation this evening. The report's core ideas were then endorsed, as Eric also indicated, by the UN World Summit Assembly of the General Assembly of the UN in 2005, which stated that, quote, each individual state has a responsibility to protect its populations from genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, and crimes against humanity. So each state has a responsibility to protect its own citizens from those grave crimes. But the UN document resulting from the World Summit went further, and it said, though, that if states fail to protect their people from these grave crimes, the international community has a responsibility to do so. First of all, and I'm going to stress this very strongly in my remarks, through peaceful means, diplomacy, all kinds of other interventions that may be of a very political and diplomatic sort, but as a last resort, and if only if ultimately necessary, by armed force. Now, this has generated a lot of controversy, both strong support and strong disagreement. And I want to address this controversy drawing on both international human rights law and on the Roman Catholic moral tradition, which has shaped my own approach to these issues. Central to the critiques of R2P, responsibility to protect, is a view that a government's responsibility is principally, or some might say exclusively, to its own people. For political realists, a state's responsibility is restricted to the protection of its own people and its own people's interests. For realists, like Henry Kissinger, for example, R2P goes beyond this limit of the role of the state in very risky ways, in ways that could destabilize the international order, or in ways that could lead to actions that are not really in the interests of the people of a particular nation state as they seek to help others. On the other hand, post-colonialist thinkers, in their view, R2P threatens the borders that protect weaker states from domination by stronger ones. Thus, Mahmoud Mamdani, who we'll hear from in a few moments, sees R2P as, along with the International Criminal Court, as what he calls a mask for a big power agenda to recolonize Africa. It goes beyond the limits of pursuing national interest and becomes a kind of justification for what some the French used to call in the colonial days la mission civilatrice, that will enable us to go and bring values to other people when we shouldn't be doing so. And Mamdani, as I'm sure we'll see in our discussion, sees parallels between this initiative justified by R2P and the U.S. intervention in Iraq, something to which he vigorously disagrees. Now, both contemporary international law and recent Roman Catholic moral thought disagree with both this realist and this post-colonialist position. In the context of his endorsement of international human rights law, in his 2008 speech at the United Nations, Pope Benedict XVI explicitly endorsed the responsibility to protect. Why? In both international law and Roman Catholic social thought, the sovereignty of states has real but not absolute value. States are subordinate to the dignity and worth of every human person. Every person belongs to one human family, a family that reaches across national and cultural borders. Thus, as Pope John XXIII stated in his encyclical of 1963, Peace on Earth, quote, "The fact that one is a citizen of a particular state does not detract in any way from his membership in the human family as a whole, nor from his citizenship in the world community," end quote. Now, the Roman Catholic tradition, I am the first to acknowledge, has certainly not been free from support for colonial undertakings. All one has to do is to look back in history a few centuries. However, the appeal to human rights and to a common humanity of all persons was central to 16th century Catholic arguments against the exploitation of indigenous people by the Spanish and Portuguese empires. For example, in 1511, Friar Anton Montesino, appealing to the common humanity of all people, denounced the Spanish imperial exploitation of indigenous people in the Americas as, quote, "mortal sin." Mortal sin in those days meant if you did it, you went to hell. Pretty serious stuff. He challenged the conquistadors in these words, "Tell me," and I quote, "with what right, with what justice, do you hold these Indians in such cruel and horrible slavery? Are they not human? Do they not have rational souls? Are you not obliged to love them as you love yourself?" End quote. Montesino's denunciations of imperial expansion by Spain and Portugal were further developed by Francisco de Vitoria, the 16th century anti-colonial moral theologian, whose thought led, in some ways, made major contributions, at least, to the development of modern international law. So it is not surprising that Pope Benedict XVI's endorsement of the responsibility to protect at the UN a few years ago explicitly cited Vitoria. R2P, I would want to argue, therefore, shares historical roots with the post-colonialist goal of protecting people against neo-imperialism. Now, this strong case, strong sense of common humanity in the Roman Catholic as well as the international human rights law traditions does not negate the role of states in international affairs. The appropriate blending of the role of national and international community is articulated in Roman Catholic thought by what's come to be called the principle of subsidiarity. This principle holds that larger or more distant powers should not intervene in people's lives unless smaller agencies cannot or will not undertake actions needed for the protection of their well-being and their rights. That means, then, the international community ought not to be intervening in nation states in the first instance, and certainly should do so only with great reluctance. Governments are, in the first order of business, the agencies to protect the rights of their citizens. Only when they fail to do so, according to this principle of subsidiarity, does the responsibility move to the international level. National self-determination, therefore, is very important, but it can be overridden if the most stringent demands of justice are being violated. That is, and the stringent demands specified by the UN World Summit meeting are limited to genocide, ethnic cleansing, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. Not what might be called routine human rights violations, but only the most severe human rights violations. Without this limitation on sovereignty, though, the sovereignty of the nation state would, in effect, become totalitarian. The state would become a kind of absolute. And therefore, there is resistance to that kind of absolutizing of the role of the state. But I would want to stress that first and foremost, R2P, the responsibility to protect, is a negative responsibility. It is initially the obligation, the responsibility of each state not to inflict grave human rights violations on its own people. Every state has a particularly grave obligation not to inflict harms that shock the conscience of humankind, as the UN Universal Declaration puts it, namely crimes such as genocide or ethnic cleansing or crimes against humanity. In addition, the international community has a responsibility not to intervene in the life of a nation, especially militarily, unless forces within that nation have failed to live up to the responsibility not to commit these grave crimes. In the doctrine of the responsibility to protect, as I want to interpret it, therefore, the responsibility not to violate self-determination and territorial integrity is presupposed. The responsibility to protect, to go a step further, can also take positive forms. Citizens have a responsibility to contribute to the common good of their own countries and to help build up the institutions within their own countries needed to protect human rights. Such positive responsibilities also exist for the international community. The World Summit of the UN in 2005 stressed that the responsibility to prevent conditions that could lead to grave crimes like genocide or crimes against humanity. There's a positive responsibility to protect, to prevent situations that could move in that direction. An example of such preventative activity, I think, that is very well worth noting and worth reflecting upon is the diplomatic activity that took place internationally in the aftermath of the 2007 election in Kenya that led in early 2008 to what has come to be called the post-election violence in Kenya, in which a couple of 100,000 people were displaced, many thousands of people were killed. There was a lot of tension and conflict in the aftermath of an election, which I would argue was a stolen election. But Kofi Annan, appointed by the UN to be a special mediator, Condoleezza Rice, the head of the African Union, the presidents and prime ministers of several African states, all descended upon Kenya and put enormous diplomatic pressure on Mwai Kibaki and Raila Odinga, the two competing candidates for the presidency of Kenya, to reach a compromise that would prevent a situation in Kenya that looked like it might be falling into a situation like that which occurred in Rwanda. Ethnic cleansing, churches being burned down with people inside of them and incinerated there. There was a lot of fear that the Kenya situation was heading toward a really violent ethnic conflict because Kenya has a long history of ethnic conflict. But the intervention that took place in 2008 by the international community is a good example, from my point of view, of the responsibility to protect being exercised in a diplomatic, preventive way that led ultimately toward the new constitution that was voted on by the American people and approved and put into action in late August of this year. Now, a second example of the positive exercise of the responsibility to protect, I think, could be what took place in bringing about the comprehensive peace agreement regarding the relation between Southern Sudan and the government in Khartoum, an agreement that was reached in the year 2005, bringing to an end a war that had been going on in Sudan, not the war in Darfur, not the conflict in Darfur, but the conflict between South Sudan and Khartoum, the northern region of Sudan, that took the lives of over almost about 2 million people, that displaced both internally and as refugees many other millions, a very, very long-standing war that lasted well over 20 years. And through intervention by the international community, led by a Kenyan general, by representatives of the United Kingdom, Norway, also representatives of the government of George Bush. George Bush was deeply involved in dispatching Colin Powell to go to Lake Naivasha, where the negotiations were taking place in Kenya, to bring about this comprehensive peace agreement, also involving the IGAD group of regional states around Sudan in eastern Africa. This process led to a peaceful resolution after 20 years and brought to an end what could be regarded as a situation in which serious war crimes and crimes against humanity were occurring. That, I think, is another example of what R2P can mean when it's looked at in a positive and preventative way. I think we need to see ways to take preventative action to help prevent that comprehensive peace agreement from falling apart when a referendum takes place in the January of this coming year. Hillary Clinton announced just last Friday that the U.S. is undertaking a major initiative in this area. Barack Obama will be at the UN by the invitation of Ban Ki-moon to work out in discussion with Sudanese officials some efforts to bring about peaceful resolution, peaceful implementation of the referendum that's going to take place about southern independence in Sudan in January. So this is moving forward. Now, the last and final and hardest question concerns military intervention. Following the International Commission's argument, military intervention under the responsibility to protect is governed strictly by the norms of just war as codified in the international law of armed conflict as it has come out from Western and particularly Roman Catholic moral thought. The UN has restricted just cause for the use of military action to the gravest human rights abuses, genocide, ethnic cleansing, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. And military action must be a last resort, by no means the first step to be taken. Harm caused by military intervention must be judged proportionate, and there must be reasonable hope that it will succeed in actually protecting people. These criteria imply that the occasions when R2P will justify military intervention will be rare. They do not, in my judgment, in any way justify U.S. military intervention in Iraq. In conclusion, R2P is in deep continuity, I think, both with the international law of human rights and armed conflict, with the deep desire in Western history to think through ways of avoiding imperialist expansion, and with the principles of Roman Catholic moral tradition that have so shaped my own thinking. Its application under contemporary circumstances of a moral commitment to the unity of the human family as a limit to state sovereignty, of the principle of subsidiarity applied to global politics, and of a strictly interpreted approach to the norms for the just resort to force seem to me to be ways in which R2P stands in deep continuity with the traditions I've mentioned. It's my hope that these moral traditions can help us interpret the responsibility to protect wisely and apply it prudently. Thank you.
While Professor Mamdani is making his way up, I ask that there are probably 15 or so seats down here that are available for people who are standing. And if you happen to prefer to sit on the steps, I ask that you stand for a second and let the people who are standing in the back of the room make their way down.
I'd like to thank my hosts for this invitation to engage in a discussion on a very contemporary topic, R2P. I teach a course called The Modern State and the Colonial Subject, which begins in 1491. And part of what I teach in the course is Las Casas's trenchant critique of Spanish horrors in South America. But I also remind my students that both the horrors of Imperial Spain and Las Casas's critique claim to be carrying out a responsibility to protect. So my argument today is going to be that if we care to go into history, we will find that the responsibility to protect is part of a lineage, a banner under which very contradictory initiatives have taken place. And if we are to take one lesson from it, it will be to shed our innocence and to come to grips with context and not just slogans. Now, I want to suggest, well, I want to begin by asking if we're witnessing a paradigm shift here. The old paradigm, the paradigm that followed the post-war decolonization, was the paradigm of state sovereignty after the Second World War. Decolonization led to the expansion of state sovereignty on a global scale. It became a global principle of relations between states. And my question is whether after the Second World War, and after the Cold War, and particularly after 9/11, we're seeing a reshaping of the international order. A reshaping whereby state sovereignty may be held accountable to an international human rights standard. And if indeed we're seeing such a reshaping, what sense are we to make of it? Let me begin by speaking of this international human rights standard. It's signified by a new language, a new rationale, responsibility to protect. It raises a set of questions. Who belongs? Who belongs to the international community? If you go into details of the institutions set up to operationalize, to realize this particular order, you will realize that the international community means in particular the Security Council, whose members are the great powers. The new language departs from the old language of law and citizenship. It describes the population to be protected as human, the crises they suffer from as humanitarian, the intervention that promises to rescue them and the agencies that seek to carry out that intervention also as humanitarian. The old language, the language of sovereignty and citizenship, was profoundly political. The new language, the language of humanitarianism, is profoundly anti-political. On second thought, I think we would realize that what we have before us is not yet a systemic transition from one paradigm to another, but what we have is a transition which claims to be limited to exceptional cases. The exceptional cases are defined as failed states or rogue states. If this is so, then this transition is likely to give rise to a bifurcated system, a system where state sovereignty will apply to most states, but will be suspended in relation to more and more countries in Africa and the Middle East. Let me speak a little more of these two paradigms. First, sovereignty and citizenship. Sovereignty and citizenship are two sides of the same coin. The citizen is member of a sovereign political community. The international humanitarian order does not acknowledge citizenship. It thinks not in terms of citizens, but in terms of wards. The rights it claims are residual rights of the citizen. The right of the human pertains to sheer survival, summed up in one word, protection. The difference is the following. Citizenship claims to turn its bearers into active participants in a process of self-emancipation. The responsibility to protect turns them into passive recipients of a charity. I'm going to argue that the consequence of R2P will be a regime of dependence that humanitarianism in the political domain heralds a system of trusteeship. And we will do well to examine older systems of colonial trusteeship. R2P, responsibility to protect, is of course always the obligation of the sovereign. In that sense, there's nothing new in this principle. What is new is that the terms are being altered. Who has the responsibility to protect whom? Under what conditions and towards what end? I think a historical understanding will shed some light on this. The international humanitarian order draws on the history, in my view, it draws on the history of modern Western colonialism. The language of trusteeship and protection can be traced to late 19th century USA. The Indians in reservations were said to be protected. Paternalism was the essence of the regime of protection. The US government was known as the Great Father, and the Indians were the wards of the Great Father. In the 19th and 20th century, leading Western powers, Britain, France, Russia, claimed to protect vulnerable groups in other parts of the world. When it came to the Ottoman Empire, they claimed to protect religious minorities, mainly Christians and Jews. When it came to lands not yet colonized, the highlighted local atrocities, real atrocities. Atrocities like Sati in India, slavery in Africa, and the claim to protect the victims of those atrocities. Colonialism was said to be an enterprise that would protect vulnerable minorities from oppressive majorities. It eventually gave rise to an international regime of trusteeship under the League of Nations. The League distributed colonial possessions of defeated powers, the Ottoman, German, and Italian possessions, to victorious powers as trust territories. The victorious powers were supposed to be guardians who would administer these territories and their populations as wards under the watchful eye of the League of Nations. One such trust territory was Rwanda. Rwanda was a Belgian trust territory until the 1959 revolution. It is under the League of Nations' watchful eye that Belgium hardened Hutu and Tutsi into racialized identities in Rwanda. It is under the watchful eye of the League of Nations that Belgium created racialized institutions, schools, chiefship, land awards, civil service, which breathed life into Hutu and Tutsi as two opposed identities. And it is under the League of Nations that Belgium prepared the institutional groundwork for the genocide that would follow a half century later. The other powers said nothing, not because they were not aware of it, but because Belgian rule was not an exception. It was just an extreme version of standard colonial practice, the practice to bring the administrative and political life of colonies under a regime of group identity and rights undergirded by a system of group discrimination. Africa is the land, or more exactly, Africa between the Sahara and the Limpopo, the Africa colonized in late 19th century, is the place where Western powers began colonization with ethnic cleansing, with creating tribal homelands. It should not be surprising that post-colonial Africa is the place of civil wars. The question is, what's the appropriate response to it? Back to colonialism and a responsibility to protect by those very powers who put this system in place, or something which would learn from the ways in which Africa has tried to come to terms with this? How would the new regime of trusteeship differ from the old one? How is this bifurcated order reproduced, this order where most states are supposed to be sovereign, but others are subject to the responsibility to protect? How do we make sense of it? How do its proponents make sense of it? They make sense of it by resort to a new language, the language of genocide. They say that this should happen only in the most extreme cases, the most extreme one being genocide. I doubt it. I'll tell you why. War has long ceased to be a confrontation between the armed forces of two states. World War II, Indochina, Gulf War, Iraq invasion, look at all of them. States do not just target armed forces of adversaries. They target society itself. They target war-related industry and infrastructure, economy and workforce, and sometimes the civilian population in general. Modern war is total war. There are no exceptions. This trajectory, this development of total war, followed an earlier development in counterinsurgency in the colonial context. It followed the realization that guerrillas are simply armed civilians. If Mao said, guerrillas are like fish in water. Samuel Huntington, my old teacher at Harvard, said, well, if they are like fish in water, let's drain the water and kill the fish. Draining the water was ethnic cleansing. Settlers in America pioneered the practice of interning the civilian population in reservations. The British called them reserves, and the Nazis developed them into an extreme form, concentration camps. The proponents of the international humanitarian order make a sharp distinction between genocide and other forms of mass violence. The R2P is supposed to be, especially as a military intervention, a response to genocide. So what is different about genocide? The difference between genocide and other kinds of mass killing is analogous to the difference between murder and manslaughter. It doesn't depend on the consequence. The difference is intent. If you intended to kill the person, it's murder. If you didn't, it's manslaughter. Murder is intended, manslaughter is collateral damage. This is how the proponents distinguish genocide from other forms of mass killing. But the distinction is untenable. For two reasons. Collateral damage may not be intended, but it's wholly predictable. If it happens over and over again, you can predict it even if you didn't intend it. As Michael Mann has shown in his book on the subject, there is hardly a situation where mass killing was intended in the first place. It is not surprising that when it comes to mass violence, the tendency is for victims to claim that they are victims of genocide and for perpetrators to claim that the violence they author is not genocide but collateral damage. My time is up, but I just should say that the main thing I would suggest after this is to think about the crises to which this R2P is supposed to be a response, to think of mass killings, and to desist from proceeding with a solution, R2P. It is only ideologues who begin with a solution. The real challenge is to figure out the problem. What is the problem? I want to suggest to you that the problem in post-colonial states, particularly in the African situation, has to be understood as one of civil war. And the antidote to that problem cannot be imported from outside, from well-meaning people, but has to be figured out by looking at the response of the African people themselves to these problems. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to thank the organizers of this event, except I'm one of them, which is my way of saying that one of the reasons I wanted to organize this event was to see if we could get Professors Hollenbach and Mandami to come and talk about their respective positions on this issue, because I was pretty sure that if that happened, we would witness two absolutely scintillatingly brilliant presentations of a different points of view. And I think that's what we've just had. And I could not be more grateful to both of you for those extraordinary remarks. I will not talk about the responsibility to protect in quite the same way that they did. I'm more interested in the question of, see, I didn't do that. Did somebody?
I don't know.
Well. Okay. Is that interfering with the filming? Thank you, Brenna. I wanted to talk a little more about our responsibilities. Do we as citizens have responsibilities to protect when we witness horrendous examples of genocide and ethnic cleansing abroad? I think the discussion has been appropriately about states, because the various documents coming from Canada and from the former foreign minister of Australia that have elaborated the concept of the responsibility to protect view it as a legal document and view states as the primary actors meant to carry out that responsibility. But what about us? What about ordinary people? When we hear of horrible things taking place elsewhere in the world, of genocides and ethnic cleansings and mass killings, do we have a responsibility to engage ourselves in trying to come to the protection of those who are victimized by these acts of violence? I can think of no better example of what I have in mind than the recent history of a campaign to try to protect the people of Darfur against what was held to be the genocidal intentions of the leaders of the Sudan in Khartoum. The Save Darfur campaign was probably the most extensive, the most public, and the most active citizens' organization ever developed in this country to come to the protection of people abroad. You all know, I believe, that famous Hollywood celebrities became involved. The star of the famous movie Hotel Rwanda, John Cheadle, was an anti-Darfur activist. Mia Farrow, George Clooney, all became very much involved in the Save Darfur campaign. From where I sit, anything that George Clooney does is likely to make me interested in the phenomenon. But it wasn't just Hollywood movie stars. Intellectuals, prominent French philosopher Bernard-Henri Lévy in the United States, writers like Christopher Hitchens, Nat Hentoff of The Village Voice, wrote at the height of the conflict in Darfur, "Of course this is genocide. It is also pure evil. Mr. Bush is not afraid of that word. Let him right now, unlike Bill Clinton in Rwanda, save lives in Darfur." A magazine that on which I happen to sit on the editorial board, The New Republic, was extremely active in the Save Darfur campaign. Richard Just, the editor at the time of The New Republic, wrote, "Radical evil has become commonplace in Darfur. It is impossible to reach any other conclusion." Radical evil, in case you don't know, is the term that Hannah Arendt coined in The Origins of Totalitarianism, borrowing it from Immanuel Kant to describe this, the horrors of the worst barbarism in history. "There are simply too many government-sponsored men," Richard Just continued, "who show up in these narratives solely for the purpose of committing almost impossible acts of cruelty." Religious groups were very active in the campaign in the Save Darfur coalition. Some 180 different faith-based organizations and humanitarian groups held rallies, sponsored speeches, and brought pressure to bear on the regime in the Sudan. The National Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. featured a prominent exhibit on who will save lives in Darfur, and it was an exhibit organized by candles all over the mall outside the exhibit, one for each life that was taken. Wall Street investment banks, General Electric, college students around the country. There even existed a video game, Darfur is Dying, sponsored by MTV and Reebok, as well as a Save Darfur black leather boot that was designed by Don Cheadle and marketed by the Timberland Company. No other group of Americans became more involved in the Save Darfur campaign than American Jewry. American Jews disagree among themselves on a wide variety of issues, from an affirmative action to the war in Iraq. American Jews are divided into Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox. But on the issue of Darfur, the entire American Jewish community was unified in the Save Darfur campaign. Of the 180 faith-based organizations that were involved in the Save Darfur campaign, 39 were Jewish, more than any other single religion, and they included the American Jewish Committee, the Anti-Defamation League, the Conference of the Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations, Hadassah, Hillel, the National Council of Jewish Women, the Religious Action Center for Reform Judaism, and the Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations of America. I know of no other issue on which a group that diverse would be united except on the issue of saving Darfur. Well, all of this, of course, sounds and should sound like a good thing. This is humanitarianism in action. This is people taking responsibility for abuses that were happening abroad. Nonetheless, I'm persuaded that the Save Darfur campaign was a mistake, and a terrible mistake, and it made the situation in Darfur even worse than it would have been had there been no such campaign. And I want to list at least a few reasons for that conclusion, and then conclude by trying to divine what this tells us about the responsibility to protect in general. I think the most serious and the most damaging consequence of the Save Darfur campaign was that in developing a narrative of genocide and applying it to Darfur, if genocide is taking place, one needs ethnic or racial conflict. That's essential to the definition of genocide. And so we were told that Darfur was violence between two ethnic groups, one called African and one called Arab, in which the Arabs, the Janjaweed militias, and the government in Khartoum was committing acts of violence against the Africans, who were the Darfuri people. A narrative that has some roots in the history of the Sudan, but that was a wildly oversimplified stereotyping of the actual situation that existed. Stereotypes are never that helpful, I think, especially racial stereotypes. But in this particular case, they played a most unfortunate role, because when you think about it for a moment, perhaps the strong and unanimous opinion of the Jewish community in this country on Save Darfur might have had a little bit less to do with the fact that Darfur was perceived as another Holocaust that Jews have a special responsibility to protect from having again, and more that the conflict was viewed with Jews coming down on the sides of so-called Africans against so-called Arabs, in which case the Jewish participation in the Save Darfur campaign looks like far more cynical effort to try to define Arabism as the major enemy of the West and to link Darfur with all other examples of Arab or Muslim-sponsored violence, such as those taking place in the Middle East. And in fact, when Christopher Hitchens and Paul Berman and a number of other prominent intellectuals wrote about Darfur, that was exactly what they said, that Darfur was just Hamas and Hezbollah, that Darfur was a product of the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem and goes back to the Hitler. That's a long story that I needn't get into here. But the idealism, the seeming idealism of the Save Darfur campaign took on a very, very different complexion once the stereotyping that was necessary to render the narrative into we have to protect people against genocide became played out. Secondly, this is what happens when humanitarian political movements get involved in a campaign like Darfur. How many people died in Darfur? Well, the usual estimate, the often cited estimate, is 200,000. But you needed a lot more than that if you were going to make a public campaign to save Darfur. After all, in Rwanda, it was 800,000 to a million. And 200,000 doesn't sound quite as dramatic. Of course, in Nazi Germany, it was 6 million. And so the Save Darfur campaign simply lied about the number of people who were being killed, with estimates from 400,000 to 600,000. In fact, the British Save Darfur campaign took out, or tried to take out, ads in the British newspapers saying that 400,000 people were dead in Darfur. But Britain, unlike the United States, has different laws about what can be published and what cannot be published. And Britain has an advertising standards commission that reviews potential advertisements in newspapers, and they refused to allow the ad to be published on the grounds that it was simply factually wrong. Whether something's factually wrong or factually right, exaggeration of the number of deaths makes political sense if you're going to mobilize a movement. But it can also cause genocide exhaustion. It could also say, oh my God, one other horrendous tragedy, one other in which the counting is running up to a million, and actually have the exact opposite consequence of the one that was intended. As a writer for the New Republic, and the New Republic played a special role in mobilizing opinion against Darfur through the efforts of an English professor at Smith College named Eric Reeves, who devoted his life to efforts to protect the people of Darfur against the presumably genocidal government in Khartoum. I found a third aspect that I found that, in my view, was somewhat disturbing. And that was a remarkable moral superiority that characterized the anti-genocide efforts in Darfur. We know it's genocide. Anyone that disagrees with us, therefore, is a Holocaust denier. Anyone that disagrees with us is indifferent or complicit in evil. The fact that someone might have a different conclusion about what was taking place there was dismissed as a mere rationalization. And the language was really quite remarkable. In the New Republic, Eric Reeves wrote as follows: "This is genocide. Let those who would deny it explain it why it is not. Eyewitness accounts of the destruction taking place there should incinerate all antagonism, agnosticism about what is happening in Darfur and all doubt about whether it's genocide." In fact, the question of whether what was taking place in Darfur was genocide or not was both a complicated and necessary discussion, and you didn't have, and you could not have that kind of discussion under that kind of language. Fourthly, I think the anti-Darfur activists raised the hopes of people in the region that help might be coming, that the responsibility to protect might actually take military form and come to the aid of the Darfur people. In reality, the United States at the time of the Save Darfur campaign was already engaged in two wars in Muslim countries, in Iraq and in Afghanistan. It was, and has been for some time, threatening war in another one, Iran. The idea that our overextended military would in any way intervene in any form or fashion in yet another Muslim country was simply off the charts. But one could understand that from the perspective of a victim of the violence, hey, there are these demonstrations. Hey, people are trying to help us. And therefore, it's only a matter of time before they come to our aid. A false hope, and a hope that I think had potentially negative consequences. The Save Darfur campaign's tactics also backfired. In one very prominent instance, the Save Darfur campaign called upon called for the existence of a no-fly zone that would prevent the government in Khartoum from launching its attacks through the air against the Darfuri people. But humanitarian groups such as Doctors Without Borders were furious at the activists because they could not fly in relief supplies and medical supplies. And one of the untold stories of the whole Save Darfur campaign is the degree to which Doctors Without Borders in particular simply hated the efforts by the political activists in the West because they so often made it much, much more difficult. It makes a certain amount of moral sense to accuse the leader of violence of that level as genocidal. But if you're a humanitarian group, for better or for worse, you must have the cooperation of the government that's being denounced if you're going to actually be on the ground. And every effort to proclaim Omar al-Bashir as a genocidal leader by the international community and by the international courts, he just simply said, okay, humanitarian workers, leave. So the moral purity we all got from denouncing him as genocide, I think, had to be countered on the ground by the fact that more lives were being lost. One last point, and then I'll stop, and that is that the Save Darfur camp became so much obsessed with saving and preventing genocide in Darfur that when the war actually ended, and it has ended, the Save Darfur campaign didn't want to acknowledge that it had ended. They were distrustful of any possibilities that the war had come to an end because they had so much mobilized their campaign that, you know, it was premised upon the war continuing. I'll conclude by just simply saying that from this example, at least from where I sit, whatever the responsibility of states to come to the protection of people who are the victims of mass violence, and whatever the responsibilities of people like us. These are enormously complicated realities. I'm not against efforts to try to come to the protection of people who are victimized by their own governments. I'm a humanitarian, and I believe we ought to. But we cannot do so naively. We must understand that it's about politics. We must take cognizance of the political realities on the ground, or else I think we're going to find ourselves ugly Americans or ugly Westerners intervening in situations that we know nothing about. Thank you.